We're talking about how summer camp looks in the age of COVID. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Day camps around the state are in full swing. What is the risk of COVID-19 spreading at these camps? What precautions are in place? How is your camper doing? And what changes were made to the structure of the program and how it's administered? We're at 800-642-1234. Rebecca Carlin is Executive Director of Wisconsin Youth Company. It's a nonprofit organization that runs 5 summer camp programs in Madison, 1 in Waukesha for children ages 5 to 12, also provides before and after school programming to thousands of children during the year. Rebecca, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks so much for having me, Kate. Good morning.
Good morning. Well, take us back, if you will, into time, into history, before the summer camps started. How did you go about making this decision to have and hold summer camps?
It was certainly a process with a lot of stops and starts. You know, thinking back to March when we closed our offices and closed our after-school programs, we were uncertain what the summer would look like and if we would be able to run camp. I remember having conversation with some of our program directors saying it doesn't even feel like camp if we're taking temperatures and wearing masks. And now we are saying we are doing all those things and it feels great because it is camp. There are happy, laughing children in our spaces. So it's certainly been a process to get there and months of a whole team of folks working to follow guidance from the CDC and public health, working with the American Camp Association and other providers to figure out how to do this safely.
How do you do it safely? How is camp different now?
There are a lot of things that are different about camp. A big one is that we are not doing swimming field trips this summer. We actually aren't doing any field trips because of the risks of transportation. So we've worked really hard to bring that fun into camp and augment the projects and the themes that we're doing. Campers are not all together in one large space as they often would. Our camps are smaller overall. We have fewer campers with us this summer. They are staying in small groups, a pod of children with, it's about 10 to 12 campers with one counselor all day. And those pods alternate through the building, but they don't commingle. They're using different bathroom spaces, different spaces for lunch. Something that is similar and also part of the precautions is spending a lot of time outside. We know that that is better and that that healthy outdoor activity is really great for kids' mental health and physical health. So we're spending a lot of time outside, a lot of time playing water games, but it looks different this year. There are health screenings when kids come to camp, taking temperatures and asking parents questions. I think one of the challenges has been in order to limit adults in our space, the number of adults who are entering camp, parents are not coming into our camp space. They're dropping their camper off at the door. And we are working hard to make sure we're communicating with parents and that they know what a great time their campers are having during the day.
I would imagine that those parents have to have a lot of trust there that they drop their child off the door. And then what happens inside is camp and also a whole abundance of precaution.
Absolutely. And I think that is something that we're working really hard to communicate with families and answer questions as they come up. You know, a lot of conversation about why we made these decisions, how we made the decisions, what guidance we're following. This is all new. We don't have all the answers, and we can't eliminate the risk of COVID-19. We can do a lot to prevent and minimize that risk for our campers, and we're doing what we know now the science says is best. And we're really partnering with parents to help communicate with children about the best ways to do hand washing and how to cover their coughs or sneezes, so that they're getting that at home and at camp.
Rebecca Carlin is executive director of the Wisconsin Youth Company, which operates day camps in Madison and Waukesha. We're looking at how summer camps are operating amid COVID. With your questions, does your child usually attend summer camp or day camps during the summer? Were they able to go to camp this year? What changes have you made this summer, and what are your kids saying about it? Join in 800-642-1234. Rebecca, what kind of capacity are you operating under right now?
We're certainly limited capacity this summer. Last summer, this week, we would have had 450 campers across all of our programs. And this week, we have 110 this year. So that's quite a difference for us. Part of that was intentional. We really wanted to start with small numbers and practice these systems and precautions and make sure that we have it down and are doing it safely in small groups of children. And part of that is that we weren't able to really make concrete plans for summer until fairly late. We weren't sure we would have space available or how we would do it. And I think a lot of parents have had to figure out what they were doing for the summer before that as well.
Are children wearing masks?
They are. So with the new public health order in Dean County, all of our children and camp counselors and staff will need to be wearing masks inside. We were previously doing that with transition periods, but not all day when children were in the classroom. And, you know, this is part of running camp in the midst of a global pandemic, is that we'll need to be flexible and follow guidance as it changes and as we learn more. And both of our families, our staff, our children are very flexible and supportive. And so yesterday was our first day of everyone wearing masks inside. And I had a staff email me and say, it went great. The kids were amazing. It was a great day. So,
what is the plan if there is an infection among campers or staff at a site?
So we'll work closely with public health in the event that that happens to determine what the exposure has been and how we need to address that in the best way. But we certainly have had lots of conversations with our staff and our families about what kind of communication is needed, what we're looking for them to tell us about what's going on, and then how we will communicate with children and families about the best way to move forward with public health guidance.
Yeah, and I suppose it is also contingent on whether it is an exposure within the pod, so to speak, or maybe within that broader child's network of family and friends.
Absolutely. Unfortunately, there is no direct way to answer that question because there are so many determining factors that we just wouldn't know until a situation arises. You know, we cannot control what happens outside of camp, where our children are, where their parents are. What we can do is do our best work to minimize all of that exposure in camp.
We're talking with Rebecca Carlin. She is executive director of Wisconsin Youth Company that provides summer camps, wraparound care during the school year. Did you withdraw your child from summer camp out of COVID safety concerns? How has your child adjusted to not being around other kids this summer? What do you want to know about camp capacity, safety precautions, and how programming is like amid the pandemic? Join in with your questions, your insights about summer, 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. We'll be back in just a minute with Rebecca Carlin right here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking about summer camp here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The summer camp experience many families count on, it includes outdoor play and field trips, opportunities to swim, super important, but that may all be on hold this summer. We're finding out how an organization that's been running camps for decades is adjusting in these times. Does your child usually attend summer day camps? Were they able to do it this year? What are your workarounds to keep your child out of camp? And if your child is going, what did they say about the experience? Join in 800-642-1234. Rebecca Carlin is executive director of Wisconsin Youth Company, which operates day camps in Madison and Waukesha. She stays with us. Rebecca, when you see your numbers go from 450 campers last summer to around 110 or so this summer, what are the implications in terms of staffing now with many fewer campers? Do you still need as many staff members?
We certainly don't have as many staff members this summer as we would normally. We also only have full-time staff members. So as part of our staffing plan to limit the number of adults coming into contact with campers, there are only full-time staff working. That's allowed us to have some of our most tenured and experienced staff with us this summer. We're very fortunate to have staff who have worked years of summer camp and are very familiar with the children, the families, and how to make camp a lot of fun. And they have been an instrumental part in the feedback and dialogue of how these new cleaning protocols, health screenings, how these new procedures are working at camp. And we're learning a lot.
What's been the financial impact of this pandemic on your operations?
We have seen significant impact. When we closed our programs during the school year, we lost the majority of our revenue from program fees and had to furlough staff. And it was a very difficult time for us. And we are very fortunate to have lots of financial supporters and receive grant funds and also federal loan programs. And so we're making it work and continuing to make it work. And I believe that we will be able to continue our programming. It's certainly changed what our financial forecast looks like.
How has it changed how you operate in terms of staffing? And you're saying full-time staff are running these camps, but these are staff who I'm sure have a lot of other jobs on their plate as well.
Certainly. And we'll see what it continues to look like into the school year with the unemployment benefit, which is fantastic. A lot of staff would rather stay on that unemployment if they're able to until they figure out how to do it safely. And we'll see. But I think we've been very fortunate because the staff that we have are excited to be at work. You know, we were wondering how it would go. How will people feel? Will there be some anxiety about returning to work where there is potential exposure? And our staff have been overwhelmingly really energized about being back in programs with kids.
What are you hearing from your colleagues and those who are running summer programs around Wisconsin, around the country?
So we're all working together. A lot of creative folks who work in our field who are problem solving each day and sharing and communicating, which is fantastic. I think we're all feeling grateful that camp is running as well as it is, and we're looking to the school year to see how we can partner with our school districts and hopefully be creative and continuing to meet the need. We know that our young people need social interaction and those practicing social emotional skills as much as they need academic work, and so we really want to see what we can make happen this school year.
We're talking with Rebecca Carlin, executive director of the Wisconsin Youth Company, which operates day camps in Madison and Waukesha, looking at the state of summer camps midsummer during the pandemic. With your situation and your questions about camp, 800-642-1234. Rebecca, what are you experiencing in terms that you could bring to the table, so to speak, for school districts and for schools as they start to figure out what they do about fall education?
I think one of the things we're learning is a lot about communicating with children and families who have been home and isolated for long periods of time and getting back to a different schedule and how to work through that. I also think we're learning a lot about these protocols around health screenings and cleaning and sanitizing things, how to do that quickly and efficiently so that it does not disturb the flow of children in programs. And we're also learning how to keep kids connected even when they're in these smaller groups all day. So we're doing fun things like art walks through the hallways where the group of children get to put all of their projects for the week out and other kids can come and see them. So the children aren't interacting, but there's still that connection. And that's going to be really important as we move forward.
How have you heard from families in terms of what the stress is doing to family units, family structures, and do you see it in the kids?
We have been doing a lot of communicating with families kind of across the board about what those needs are and how they're feeling. And overwhelmingly, what we're hearing from families in all different situations is that parents really need a break and their children really need time with friends. And I think we're seeing some of that stress relieved this summer, which is fantastic. And we'll all have to put our heads together to figure out how to continue that support through the school year.
Okay, so when the child is in their pod in, I would assume, a classroom setting with their other campers who are with them for that week, what are they doing?
That's a great question. And I think a lot of our parents had that same question. So we've created a newsletter, but they're doing the things that you think of for camp. They're making bird feeders out of milk cartons, and they're making art projects using potatoes to print and fun things like that. They made homemade chia pets the other day. It does look a little bit different in terms of rather than a group of children sharing the same art supplies, each child has their own kit. We've also worked really hard to make our projects a little bit more educational based so that we're helping with some of that learning loss that we anticipated happened through the school year. And we're also doing a lot of outside water games and outside physical activity.
And I would imagine even when you head outside, you also have to think about what kids are touching and what they could potentially be sharing.
Absolutely. And so, you know, we're really working to modify some things so that there's more distance and less contact. So doing similar activities, for example, our counselors have been really creative in creating relay races where children can all participate together, but they're distant from each other and they're not touching the same objects. It takes a lot of creativity, but they've come up with some really fun things.
What questions do the kids have? What is on their mind?
I think what we've seen most is that kids are very flexible and really excited to be with their peers. I think there are questions that come up, and we did a lot of training with our staff before the summer started about how to have those conversations. And our philosophy is that children really work best when they hear the facts in a way that they can understand, and we share that information and really let them lead the conversation, listen to how they're feeling and what their thoughts and questions are, and just create the space for them to talk about it.
How are you sharing the information that you're learning through the summer camp process with schools? What are the communication lines like?
So we operate in several different school districts across Dane and Waukesha counties throughout the year, and we have had great district partners. So who that is at each district looks a little different, but lots of regular conversation about how summer is going, what we're learning, and how we might be helpful in the fall.
What is your toughest challenge that you're really grappling with as executive director?
I think, like most people, the greatest challenge is how much is unknown. That we cannot create a timeline and a roadmap for moving forward because we are lacking a lot of information, and we are, because this is so new to all of us, and we're not sure when. There are so many decisions outside of our control that we just don't know when those will happen. For example, I know a lot of districts are waiting for some specific guidance from public health about opening in the fall. And once we get that, we'll all be able to move forward a little bit further. And it is hard to wait and see what will happen.
And meanwhile, I would assume you're putting contingency plan after contingency plan together.
That is absolutely correct, Kate. We joke about our plans A, B, C, D, and E, and then how they'll change, and we'll come up with a new plan after that. And that is a lot of work and energy, and I feel very fortunate to have a really dedicated and hardworking staff team who are committed to figuring this out for our families.
Rebecca, thank you for joining us.
Kate, thanks so much for having me.
Rebecca Carlin is executive director of the Wisconsin Youth Company, operating day camps, wraparound care in school in Madison and Waukesha. Coming up, we talk with U.S. Senator Ron Johnson about pandemic aid and more. What do you want the senator from Wisconsin to prioritize on Capitol Hill? Join in 800-642-1234. We'll be back with Senator Johnson after this news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We have U.S. Senator Ron Johnson on the line. For Wisconsinites out of work, budgeting may be extremely difficult. What do you want to tell Senator Johnson about how Congress should handle pandemic aid? How do you feel about another stimulus? What do you want to say about the HEROES Act that House Democrats passed in May? We're at 800-642-1234. Ron Johnson is a Republican in the Senate. He chairs the Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee. Senator Johnson, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. How are you doing? Hope you're staying healthy.
I am. Later this month, people out of work due to the pandemic will stop receiving the $600 weekly payments. Should these payments be extended?
Not at that level. I proposed earlier in phase two that we should be doing is plussing up state unemployment insurance to no more than two-thirds of somebody's average weekly earnings. That, you know, obviously doesn't make people whole, but it certainly doesn't create a disincentive for returning to the workforce. There was one report in the Wall Street Journal that 68% of people receiving unemployment benefits were actually making more on unemployment than they were making in their job, and that's a pretty perverse disincentive to return back to the workplace, which is what we need people to do as much as possible, as safely as possible.
Well, unemployment in Wisconsin maxes out at 370 a week, and we're still seeing tens of thousands of Wisconsinites not getting their unemployment benefits processed. Would you see an increase there on the state level?
Well, the state's got to get its act together. That's one of the issues when we were discussing the CARES Act is, you know, states' capability of actually being able to plus up benefits as some percentage as opposed to just a flat fee. In the end, Congress decided to make the $600 flat payment, and it still didn't work. So, you know, from my standpoint, what I'd like to do is probably make it optional to states if they can handle a percentage of people's wages, and they ought to be able to do that. I mean, the state of Wisconsin, for example, that's a fraction of somebody's weekly earnings, which they have to calculate as well. So those states that have capability of providing some type of percentage of weekly wages, again, I would plus that up to two-thirds. That's what I proposed in an amendment to phase two. Otherwise, a reduced flat fee for those states that simply can't handle it would be my suggestion.
In phase two, would you then support the federal government provide another stimulus package?
Well, I wasn't a fan. I wasn't supportive, really, of the $1,200 payment initially. We need to target the financial support to those people that truly need it, to those businesses that we want to be able to survive so they can reopen and rehire once COVID passes. The problem with the shotgun approach we used is we just flooded hundreds of billions of dollars into the economy. This is not a classic type of recession. This is something caused by a virus, and we need to be smarter in terms of how we're providing the financial assistance, which we all want to provide. And we were trying to be as inclusive as possible to provide those employees that were put out of work because of COVID, as well as those businesses, the financial aid they need to survive. But we did it across the board, and we do not have an unlimited checking account. We authorized $2.9 trillion. And just to put that in perspective, many economists, when we started into this COVID, these shutdowns, about 30% of our economy was shut down. $2.9 trillion is about 5 months worth of total replacement costs of 30% of our economy. We've allocated, authorized a massive amount of money. We just didn't do it in a very targeted fashion. So my suggestion moving forward, we haven't spent about $1.2 to $1.3 trillion of that $2.9 trillion. So rather than authorize more spending, what we ought to do is take a look at what we've done, what worked, what didn't work, what can be fixed, what can be targeted better, and repurpose and redirect the $1.2, $1.3 trillion that still hasn't even been obligated, much less spent.
All right. So taking stock, though, takes time. What is the timeline then for figuring out how much penetration you're getting through the CARES Act?
Well, information is difficult to develop. It's hard actually to get the actual spending amounts. Again, that's government, which is just unfortunate. The government's not particularly efficient at these types of things. But I've been looking into this ever since we passed the CARES Act, and it's certainly been the type of information I've been providing my colleagues. And, you know, these types of suggestions, for example, I wrote this up in the Wall Street Journal, something to replace capital that has been wiped out, you know, particularly at the lower end of the business spectrum, you know, the small businesses that never had a bank loan outstanding. They were last in line. Some of them didn't get the PPP loans. You know, from my standpoint, what we should be doing is looking at some manner of type of grant program, but those grants would be contingent on, for example, a new ownership structure designed around an employee stock ownership program. I think that would be very, very helpful in terms of equality, in terms of economic results, that type of thing. So I'm just hoping my colleagues will start thinking outside the box. This is in completely unusual economic circumstance right here. We can't put the same types of cures toward this situation as we would during a normal type of slow down in demand type of recession.
Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin said in an interview last week that another stimulus bill will pass by the end of the month. What are the sticking points right now in the Senate?
Well, from my standpoint, it's again, I'm happy to pass a bill that redirects and repurposes the $1.2, $1.3 trillion that hasn't been spent. But until we do that analysis, and until we actually fix some of the problems with the $2.9 trillion and redirect the $1.2 to $1.3 that hasn't been spent, I would not be in favor of authorizing not even a dime more.
What agency is going to fix those issues?
Well, it's going to, partly small business, but this is really going to be the Treasury Department as well as the Federal Reserve in terms of what they're doing with Main Street lending. A lot of those authorities have not been used. The programs weren't particularly well designed. They're not focused on exactly what the problem is here today. For example, PPP program was really designed to keep employees tied to their employer. And so we provided 8 weeks worth of funding to keep those employees working and paid through their employer. But COVID's lasts more than 8 weeks. And some of these businesses, whether you're talking about bars and restaurants where people are still going to be very reluctant to go into those risky situations, that they may be mothballed for quite some time. And we need to recognize that fact.
We are catching up with Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson with your questions along the way. Still time for you, 800-642-1234. Senator Johnson, your colleague Senator Mitch McConnell last week suggested distributing money to people making $40,000 a year or less. What do you think of an income cutoff for a second round of stimulus checks?
Well, again, we need to target financial aid to those individuals who have been harmed by COVID. And again, we want to be very inclusive. But at the same time, there should be some measure of income test. But from my standpoint, I don't want to see an across-the-board stimulus checks sent out to people. I think that the history of that is pretty clear. It's really never worked. I don't know why we think it would work in this very unusual circumstance as well. So I'm all about targeting.
What gauge would it work?
Financial aid.
Yeah, I mean, how would you see an across-the-board stimulus check working? What indicator would you see in the economy?
I wouldn't think an across-the-board stimulus check ever works. I think you need to target it in terms of capital formation, business formation, hiring, those types of things. And so I think, again, one of the mistakes we've made in COVID is I think shutdowns were way too broad. We didn't focus on those non-essential businesses that truly represented a risk for out-of-control spread. Remember, the whole purpose of shutdowns was to flatten the curve so that we wouldn't overwhelm our healthcare system, which by and large we haven't done. You know, we succeeded from that standpoint, but we shut down way too many businesses, put way too many people on unemployment, and let's recognize the mistakes we made and focus our efforts in the future, again, on those non-essential businesses that represent a real risk for out-of-control spread. And then if we target it that way, it's going to be a lot easier and a lot less expensive to focus financial aid to those employees and those employers.
Let's bring in a call. Dennis in Onalaska. Hi, Dennis.
Yeah, I disagree with the $600 of unemployment. We have people making more on unemployment than they were working. The government should have came in and said, "You pay, state, you pay your unemployment, and we'll match their wages up to 95%. So they're not getting hurt too bad, but there's still incentive to go back to work. The $600, who wants to go back to work? You're making more laying at home."
And Dennis, this echoes what Senator Johnson has said.
So, Dennis, I'm on the exact same page. And again, listen, we can debate, you know, what percentage of people's wages, but we shouldn't be paying people more to stay on unemployment than they get paid. Let's take an example of a factory that had to lay off half its workers. How would you like to be one of those workers that were deemed essential for that business, continued to work, continued to be productive, but actually you made less than the people, you know, your fellow workers got laid off and are on unemployment? That's not a particularly fair situation either, and it's economically harmful. It's a very perverse incentive.
Senator Johnson, the national party conventions are nearly a month away. Do you plan to go to the RNC in Jacksonville despite the recent surge in Florida of cases?
I haven't made my decision yet. Kind of depends on really what the situation is with the COVID at the point in time and exactly what my role might be. I wouldn't expect I'd have much of a role. So, again, I'll make that decision later. Yeah, listen, I take COVID very seriously. I know as roundly criticized early on when I made the analogy, which I still think is quite good, that even though we tragically lose 36,000 people a year on the highways, we don't shut our highway system down. We're going to have to learn to live with COVID-19. There's no guarantee that we're going to have a vaccine. We need to recognize the human toll of the economic devastation as well. We have to put these things in perspective. Again, I'm not downplaying COVID. I don't want to get it. You know, certainly I wear a mask in the types of situation where we're going to grocery stores or any type of confined space where you need to wear a mask. I encourage that type of use. But I don't wear a mask because I'm walking outside on a hike either. So, you know, we're getting more and more information. We'll get more information, and we need to actually utilize that information in our response.
Senator Johnson, thank you for joining us.
Have a great day. Stay healthy.
You too. That was U.S. Senator Ron Johnson. If you missed any part of our conversation, you can stream it, download it later today at WPR.org/mornings. Coming up, we revisit Sun Prairie 2 years after a deadly gas explosion. We'll be back in a moment. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. It's been 2 years since drillers struck a gas line and caused a deadly explosion in Sun Prairie. Federal authorities estimate the Madison suburb saw more than $20 million in economic damages to the downtown. A firefighter killed, 5 buildings were destroyed, several other businesses and homes were damaged, leaving dozens of residents displaced. It took more than 4 months to rebuild. WPR host Keely Boltina talked with reporter Parker Shore from the Capital Times and Wisconsin Watch about what has changed.
It's been about 2 years since an explosion in Sun Prairie killed one person. Remind us what happened that day in July of 2018.
Right. So a company by the name of Bear Communications was hired by Verizon to install fiber internet under the streets of Sun Prairie. And on the morning of the explosion, Bear Communications actually assigned the job to a brand new subcontractor. It's common practice in the industry, especially in what's called directional drilling, which is what these companies were doing that day, to sort of subcontract out the work to other companies. So a company will hire a company, which will hire a company, and so on. And so they hired this company by the name of BC Tech because they wanted the job done sooner than the previous company would have done it by. And before you dig, you're required to call Digger's hotline, which coordinates with locating companies to spray paint where utilities are underground. But neither company did this on that morning. And as a result, BC Tech, as they were digging, struck an unmarked natural gas pipeline near an intersection. And the pipeline leaked gas for about an hour and then ignited into this massive explosion, which destroyed numerous buildings in the downtown area. It caused $20 million in damage and killed firefighter Captain Corey Barr.
So the company drilling that day was not the original company, and it changed the morning of?
Right. So the plans were actually transferred in the parking lot of a quick trip because the Bear Communications wanted the job done sooner than the previous company would have gotten it done by. The previous company wanted new, more detailed plans to be drawn up because they thought the intersection had too many utilities to safely do the job with the plans that they had. And Bear Communications wanted the job done within a few days. So they hired this new company to get it done sooner.
That new company, VC Tech, did their work cause the explosion?
Yes. The driller for VC Tech struck the underground pipeline, which ultimately ignited and exploded.
And is that a crime?
The police did ruled it not a crime. They sort of chalked it up to miscommunication between all these different companies. And Sun Prairie has since sort of instituted some rules to make sure that these companies are communicating. But no crime was committed, the police determined. There are some lawsuits sort of grinding their way through the courts still. And the companies were fined by the Public Service Commission, which regulates this industry, for $25,000 each. So Bear Communications and VC Tech were both fined. But VC Tech actually has not paid that fine, at least when we published this article in late April. And they are back in Wisconsin doing the same work that they were doing in Sun Prairie, directional drilling to install fiber internet. They're back working in Wisconsin under a new company name. And the PSC, the Public Service Commission, said it's worried about this company working in Wisconsin, but admitted it had little ability to do anything about it.
Let's take a quick step back then. What is directional digging and how difficult is it?
It's a sort of relatively unknown industry. They do all their work underground, and it can be kind of innocuous, but it's basically a way to dig underground and install utilities that doesn't require you to dig a big trench. So basically the directional driller will extend this long, thin metal drill into the ground and then feed a utility through the drill. So you feed like a fiber internet cable through the center of the drill, and that's how they install a lot of the fiber internet and electric cable and other types of utilities nowadays. I talked with people that compared it to sort of operating a crane, which requires a lot of training to do. But directional drilling requires zero training in Wisconsin.
You can hire somebody and tell them how to do it, and legally they can.
Right, and I think that's a common way that it happens, that you learn on the job. You learn from the person that's teaching you, and maybe they don't have the best practices, because there aren't necessarily best practices being taught like you would if you're a crane operator, for instance, and you're a certified crane operator, which then you have to be recertified to do so. But there's none of those sort of training requirements or really much regulation of directional drilling at all.
Parker, what can Wisconsin do to enforce any penalties companies face if they've messed up?
So Wisconsin law, since 2018, they have sort of this new ability to fine companies that they find have violated laws. And since that law was instituted in 2018, they've only fined three companies a total of $31,000. And that's despite through this reporting, finding that companies violate the state's excavation laws hundreds of times every year, it appears. That could be not calling Digger's hotline, which is common, and that's what happened in Sun Prairie. But it can also be digging too close to utilities with a power-operated machinery. When you get really close to a utility, you're by law required to start digging with hand tools like a shovel. And that causes hundreds of utility strikes every year. And yet, the vast majority of these companies are not fined or required to take an educational course. But the state law does have room that would allow for that.
Sun Prairie's incident was significant, but how big of an issue really is this? How often do crews hit utility lines when they're working on projects in Wisconsin?
So utility strikes are actually shockingly common. So there were nearly 4,000 utility lines that were struck in Wisconsin in 2018 alone, including 31 that were struck on the day of the Sun Prairie explosion alone. That being said, most of these they turn out to be harmless, but they can turn deadly as they were on that morning. So excavators triggered about 5 significant Wisconsin pipeline incidents over the past decade. And the Sun Prairie explosion was the first death caused by one of these strikes since 2006. But these strikes are common, and industry experts I talked to said cutting corners is a widespread issue in directional drilling. For instance, it's best practice to dig a sight hole to see where the utility is underground as you're directional drilling. But companies skip this step often to save time and money, and that results in a significant number of these utility strikes, data shows.
So who winds up paying for it when companies violate the regulations or misstep?
Often it would be an insurance company would pay for damages. But sometimes the costs are borne by the people that pay for the utility. For instance, the a municipally owned water utility, the people that pay for that water would end up paying it. So taxpayers would end up, basically residents would end up sort of bearing the cost of those damages in some cases.
Parker, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
And that was reporter Parker Shore talking with WPR host Keely Baltina. You can read the full Wisconsin Watch article on Wisconsin's regulations and see more about the regulations on drilling and other places, how they handle drilling restrictions. We have a link at WPR.org/mornings. Just ahead, it is on point with a recap of the SCOTUS season. The Supreme Court ended last week with surprises from just about everyone, or so it seemed. We take a detailed look at the Roberts Court and how to understand its decisions in the larger context of American politics now. That is On Point coming up next. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show, and you're here on the Ideas Network.